In Fremont, California, thousands of auto workers are facing an uncertain future. Toyota has announced it will shutter the plant called NUMMI. It was a unique joint venture, a partnership between Toyota and General Motors, but GM pulled out this past summer. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, widespread layoffs will aggravate an already painful job market in Fremont and beyond.
At the Union Hall of UAW Local 2244, a meeting of retired workers is breaking up. The hottest topic of conversation is the impending closure of NUMMI in March of next year. What does it mean for retirees' pensions and health benefits, not to mention the workers who are still on the job? So far, there are more questions than answers. 75-year-old Willie King worked for NUMMI for 20 years.
We should be sitting down with the company, working out each issue so that the employees would know exactly what they got coming based on what they're entitled to.
People don't have that information right now?
No, they don't have that information right now.
Ever since Toyota announced in late August that it will shutter the Fremont plant, an air of uncertainty descended over its workforce. Neither Toyota nor the union has said much about how the shutdown will be handled. What is certain is that some 4,700 auto workers will be unemployed, including 46-year-old Karen Connors. She's worked at NUMMI for more than two decades.
My husband works here too. This plant goes down, both incomes are gone. So basically, my son's college fund is going to pay our mortgage.
The impact of the NUMMI shutdown will likely be felt all over the San Francisco Bay Area, especially by an estimated 20,000 workers employed by local parts suppliers. That's why the state legislature still hopes to convince Toyota to change its mind and stay open. Lawmakers are offering Toyota or any other automaker tax cuts and other incentives to manufacture cars in Fremont, but it's probably too late. Michelle Krebs, an auto industry analyst for Edmunds.com, says NUMMI's shutdown makes economic sense.
It has to ship a lot of the parts that are made in the Midwest out to California. A lot of its vehicles are sold in California, so you don't have trucks and rail cars coming back loaded with vehicles that can return for the parts. So the logistics of it are expensive.
Krebs says another strike against the NUMMI plant is its age. It originally opened under GM's management in 1962. She says the closure is a sign that Toyota simply expanded production too fast and wound up with excess capacity when car sales tanked. Others say NUMMI's closure is a wake-up call for California.
Really, it proves what many have been saying about California over the past few years, and that is that California is just not a competitive place to do business.
Gino DeCaro is a spokesman for the California Manufacturers and Technology Association. He says high energy costs, taxes, and a heavy regulatory environment all make California a very tough place for manufacturers.
Since January of 2001, California has lost 580,000 manufacturing jobs. That's 30% of the state's industrial base.
Back at the Union Hall, retiree Willie King shakes his head at the thought of how the NUMMI auto workers will fare in a job market where unemployment is running at around 12%. But he says he likes to stay optimistic.
My concern is for the people. I hope the people realize that before NUMMI existed, they survived. And that once NUMMI no longer exists, they still will survive. And, you made NUMMI. NUMMI didn't make you.
And King says he holds no ill feelings towards Toyota. After all, it's a business, he says. And if they can't make money, they won't be here. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. On Wall Street, there's the question, is it too big to fail? And increasingly these days, another question, how much is too much? The Federal Reserve is looking at how banks compensate their employees. It's concerned that many still use bonuses and other incentives in ways that create too much risk. The Fed is working on guidelines that would, for the first time, put it in the position of ruling on pay packages at the thousands of banks it regulates. And NPR's John Idstey joins us to talk about the Fed initiative. John, first of all, does the Fed really have this authority to tell private companies, here's what you can pay your employees?
Well, the Fed says its authority to do this comes from its responsibility to ensure the safety and soundness of the financial firms it regulates. And there's pretty broad agreement that faulty compensation practices encouraged too much risk-taking and contributed to the financial crisis and to the collapse of lots of financial companies. So the Fed believes it has the responsibility to be involved in compensation policies.
And how would the Fed try to make sure that employees aren't encouraged to take too much risk to inflate their compensation?
Well, the Fed hasn't yet issued its guidelines, and it isn't talking publicly about exactly what it will propose. But a source familiar with the Fed's thinking told NPR that the Fed is not going to set pay caps or develop a pay schedule. What it will do is issue a set of principles that it expects the financial companies it regulates to follow. That will happen within a few weeks. There will be a comment period, and the Fed hopes the policy will be in place by the end of the year.
Okay, well, translate that a bit. Principles for the banks to follow. What would that be?
Well, one possibility is to make sure bonuses are adjusted for the amount of risk taking. You want to make sure employees don't get a bigger and bigger bonus for taking more and more risk. Another principle might be to defer bonuses so you have a longer evaluation period. So instead of rewarding a loan officer for the number of mortgages written each month, you base the bonus on how well the mortgages perform over several years.
And we're not talking here about just high-level executives, John. This could apply all the way down to employees deep into a bank loan department.
That's absolutely right. Any employee who is in a position to put the institution at a significant risk would be subject to these principles.
And how many people would we be talking to? How would the Fed go about enforcing this?
Well, tens of thousands of people. It'll be a big job. What I'm told is that the Fed will issue the guidelines, and then banks will develop their own compensation plans based on these principles. The Fed will then focus on the plans of the two dozen biggest financial institutions, the ones that could pose the greatest danger to the financial system. If the Fed sees something it doesn't like, the bank will have to make changes. The pay plans at the thousands of other smaller banks the Fed regulates would be reviewed during their periodic examination by regulators.
And I'm sure banks are thrilled to think about more regulation coming from the Fed.
They're never excited about more regulation. But when I talked to Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable and Industry Group today, he acknowledged that the Fed has the authority to do this. But then he added this.
Obviously, we're worried that the rules could be too draconian and have a blanket or a stifling effect on the company and reduce its ability to generate revenue, which would ultimately weaken the institution and make it less safe and sound.
Now, the Fed is, of course, not the only institution addressing this issue. The U.S. government has already set limits on compensation at firms that got aid during the crisis. A House committee has passed a bill also aimed at risky pay packages. And the Europeans want to take action on the subject at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh next week. So it remains a hot topic.
Okay. NPR's John Idstey. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
Forget the G20 this week. The real meeting of rival superpowers was in Bavaria, Germany today. That's where a soccer match took place featuring players wearing rival footwear, Adidas and Puma, players who work at those rival companies. The game is remarkable because of a long-standing bitter feud between the iconic sneaker makers. It goes back to Germany in the 1940s when shoemaking brothers Adolf and Rudolf Dassler had a falling out. One founded Adidas, the other Puma. Barbara Schmidt, author of the book Sneaker Wars, explains how the rivalry got started.
Well, that joint company worked pretty well for some time, but it became apparent fairly quickly that they had very different personalities. Adolf was really the cobbler. He was a rather quiet man, whereas Rudolf was a more outspoken, typical sales type person, if you like, cigar chomping. Basically, the tensions arose over the years, but it really came to a boiling point during the war when Rudolf Dassler was sent to the front in what is today Poland, and after his return was picked up by American soldiers. And so he was imprisoned for about a year in Germany. And, of course, he was fairly convinced that this came from his brother's side and the will to have him evicted from the company.
Could you argue, though, that this rivalry actually turned these companies into multinational success stories and transformed the sneaker business, or actually created a sneaker business?
Well, I mean, certainly if you were an athlete in the 60s or the 70s, it was pretty easy because all you had to do is go to Herzog and, you know, cross the river a couple of times and up the stakes. And that's what quite a few people did. The rivalry did contribute to shape, sports marketing, really.
This rivalry took place in a small town in Bavaria. How did it manifest itself in this small town where the brothers grew up?
Well, for several decades, the town really was split in two. People really had to take sides. They were either Adidas or Puma, and in fact, Herzo, as it's known in short, became known as the town of the bent necks, because you always look at people's shoes before and see what they were wearing before you strike up a conversation. You actually had Adidas bakers, Puma bakers, and people from one side would preferably go to that school and not to the other school. And the town was totally divided for quite a while.
So today's soccer match will do what for the two companies?
I don't think it will change very much between the two companies, because the business rivalry, of course, remains totally intact. Then again, on a personal level, I mean, I did receive personal messages from various people. It all seems pretty good-humored. And for some of them, yeah, it probably will be the first time that they actually are in contact with people from the other side at a personal or sports kind of level.
Barbara Smith is the author of the book Sneaker Wars, The Enemy Brothers, who founded Adidas and Puma, and the family that forever changed the business of sport. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My Adidas walk through closet doors and roam all over Coliseum floors.
Well, we know what side Run-DMC is on. The winner of today's soccer game, it was management. Adidas and Puma employees played on mixed teams. The team that had both CEOs on it, that team won.
While we're on the subject of sneakers, we'd like to hear your sneaker story. Send us a photo of you and your favorite sneakers and tell us why you love them, whatever the brand. Were you wearing them when you met your significant other or when you ran in the Boston Marathon? Send us your sneaker story with photo attached to sneakers@npr.org, and we'll put the best stories on our website.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.